coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
This is an approach that's based on data, lots of data. So it's something that can't happen tomorrow. But if you imagine us 10 years in the future, and imagine you're a therapist, a psychedelic therapist, and helping someone with, let's say, post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's their first visit, this patient or research participant, depending on where we're at, has already had a deep biometric evaluation. Then during the treatment itself, I picture being able to apply these sensors in the future. We could do it in a way that's very non-invasive, non-threatening to the patient. And the therapist could, you know, administer the compound. Let's say it's psilocybin, for lack of a better one right now in this discussion. And the therapist would then have access to an entire, let's say, a visualization to make it accessible, maybe putting on even a virtual reality headset and being able to see what I think of as an experience landscape. So picture a mountain range where all these different aspects, these peaks and valleys, are reflecting different aspects of stress and arousal and attention and awareness, and you're watching it change over time. So you're not quite in their brain, but getting a visualization of their mind as they go through this journey. So again, peering inside the black box is now possible. And the therapist has all of this data that they're receiving that allows them to understand where the person is in that moment.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts. Presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome back to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. What if a therapist could peer inside of the black box of a patient's psychedelic experience? Well, Adam Ghazali and his Neuroscape team at UCSF are using multimodal biosensing research to make that dream a reality. On the show, Adam explains the concept of experiential medicine and how the brain modifies itself in response to experience. He shares his previous work, creating a video game that is also a Class 2 medical device for ADHD. He relates his long inquiry with shamans and psychedelic therapists to understand how to design good set and setting research studies. We explore what the future of psychedelic therapy could look like with a data-rich AI assistant and the potential concerns therapists might have about the possibility of replacement by technology. Finally, as always, Adam shares a message to psychedelic healers and those who aspire to be. Adam Ghazali is an American neuroscientist, author and photographer, entrepreneur, and inventor. He is the founder and executive director of Neuroscape and the David Dolby Distinguished Professor of Neurology, Physiology, and Psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. The new Neuroscape Psychedelics Division will be led by Robin Carhart-Harris and is dedicated to advancing the field of psychedelic science and medicine through multi-level research covering basic to translational to clinical science. And now, here is Adam Ghazali. Adam, welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. It is such an honor to have you here. The work that you are doing and the work that you are poised to do in the space of psychedelic medicine is quite awe-inspiring. And you've managed to wrangle Robin Carhart-Harris, who is quite beloved in this community and who has recently been on this podcast. You've managed to wrangle him over across the pond to our fair city of San Francisco. And for that, in the very least, you get kudos. It's just such an honor to get to talk to you. And I know that many of our audience members are waiting with bated breath to see what sort of technological tools are going to be available to support their work. And you're going to be one of the people at the forefront of that. So thank you so much for coming on the show and speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me here. Excited to chat with you.
So there's so much that you've done to get you to this point. And I feel like we could do a podcast about video games as experiential medicine. We could do a podcast about your work at UCSF. There's so many different podcasts we could do. But just in terms of psychedelic medicine, I know that you've been in San Francisco for a while, so you've been around conversations around psychedelics. I'm curious, when in your career did you start to think of psychedelic medicine as being a key galvanizing force in this broader concept of experiential medicine that you've been looking at for quite a while?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually very pretty recently. 2.5 years ago, I started trying to expand my mind and think about what the next phase of our research was at UCSF, where, as you described, we advance experiences as medicine. This was something that was very dear to me. I thought it was a big gap in our medicine toolkit, certainly from the FDA-approved mainstream medicine, and how we can, in a more targeted manner, personalize treatments that are experiential has sort of been my quest for a decade now. But it wasn't until relatively recently, as I said, that I started talking to friends around San Francisco, asking them about what was exciting to them in medicine now. Some of them were investors and others were entrepreneurs and, you know, or just people very into health and wellness. And psychedelics kept coming up again and again as an area of interest to them. And these are people I respect. And I had, of course, known about psychedelics and its medicinal uses, but frankly, never learned it in any of my neuroscience education or neurology education. And so I had a big gap in my understanding of how it might serve a role or how it might be part of our work at Neuroscape. And it was really the introduction offered by Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, along with many other people, really opened up my eyes to psychedelics, not just as medicine, but as an experiential medicine. And once I was able to wrap my head around that, I realized that this could be a perfect area of focus for Neuroscape.
Experiential medicine. I was having a conversation with Dr. Rachel Yehuda about how a single experience can radically change not just someone's idea of themselves or psychology, but actually their neurology, actually the way that their brain works. I mean, we were talking about PTSD as a significant experience like a car accident or a natural disaster or a series of experiences a la complex PTSD that can actually change the way your brain works. And then on the side of medicine, that there are experiences that can heal these changes, these traumas, and can positively affect the neuroplasticity of the brain. So where are we at in our current research and understanding of how an experience can actually change the brain?
Well, in some aspects, it's one of the largest, most successful areas of neuroscience research. It just hasn't always been framed in this context of experience as medicine. When I started thinking about that term, experiential medicine, I did a big Google search, as you always do, and it just really wasn't a term. I was actually able to even get the URL for experientialmedicine.com just a couple of years ago, which is surprising because there are other experiential things, like experiential learning is a big area. So experience as medicine as a terminology, or even maybe even as a concept, wasn't really being applied. But experience as a way of changing the brain is a fundamental aspect of neuroscience research. It's the cornerstone of an area in our field called neuroplasticity, which I'm sure all your listeners are quite familiar with. And I've been studying that for 30 years since I was a graduate student, actually at Mount Sinai, where Rachel is now. That was in 1990. My early work was all looking at neural mechanisms, molecular mechanisms, how neurotransmitter receptors mediate changes in the brain. And what we fundamentally base most of our modern day neuroscience on is that the brain has plasticity, meaning that it modifies itself at every level, its structure, its chemistry, its function, all aspects of physiology, oscillatory patterns. It's just pretty much every way that we could look at the brain, it modifies itself, often in response to experience. So experience-dependent plasticity is a very fundamental neuroscience focus. And it is the study of the mechanisms by which experiences change the brain. Now, some of those experiences, many of them that are studied, occur during development, when our brain is incredibly plastic and we're laying the foundations for an adult brain, all the networks that establish your whole perceptual basis of reality and how you form memories are all part of this plasticity process. But we now know that plasticity, as I said, it's often in response to experience, occurs throughout our lives. That's something that we didn't always appreciate, but it occurs till the day we die. Our brains have this capacity to modify itself in response to experience. And it's important to point out that experience is not the only thing that induces neuroplasticity. The brain also has a compensatory response to injury. So it is also a response that is part of healing of the brain as well. But there's very similar mechanisms involved. And so, long answer, we know a lot about plasticity and the brain from a fundamental basic neuroscience perspective. We know the molecules involved, things like long-term potentiation. We know the changes that occur in dendritic arborization, which is part of a neuron's receptive capacity. We know about axonal sprouting, which is how a neuron sends out messages. We know all of those changes in response to all different types of experiences. I think what's novel now is that we globally, the innovative part of the medical community, people that are trying to advance into new frontiers for medical treatment, especially for neurological and psychiatric conditions, are embracing neuroscience explanations or neuroscience intuitions about how plasticity occurs as a foundation of medicine. And that's what I think is really exciting here.
It's so exciting. And I love that we have an hour to talk about it. You know, I grew up thinking that, you know, you go through developmental stages and then you're kind of landed where you are as an adult. And there's a kind of decline that happens. But you've proven, in fact, through some of your work with video games, that that's not true at all. And that's so thrilling for all of us as we age to be like, oh, wow, you can teach old dogs new tricks if you have the right tools at your disposal. So let's talk a bit about the tools that kind of got you to this particular precipice, because you've been extremely impactful in the realm of video games. In fact, taking a video game through the FDA process as a medicine. I believe you're the first person who has created a video game that is a medicine. Is that correct?
True. Recently correct, but yes, that is true.
Which is super exciting. And it's going to kind of dovetail really beautifully into our conversation about the technological component of psychedelic medicine later. So I'd love for you to just briefly share with us a little bit about NeuroRacer and some of what you've worked on with this video game approach to experiential medicine.
Sure. So a little over a decade ago, I became frustrated with the status quo in my field in aging, cognitive aging. So I had for many years, you know, for 20 years before that, been studying the aging brain. And that's not the happiest of stories. And all of us are experiencing it. If you're over 23, you're aging, your brain is aging. And, you know, there are certainly aspects of our mental capacity that sustain throughout age or even improve, like wisdom. But many functions decline and we all feel it as we get older. And it's not the only thing that ages. Hair ages and all different aspects of our bodies change. But I became frustrated with research on just understanding the mechanisms of those changes or even describing them and wanted to help with approaches to improve cognition with aging, or at least maintain it. And attention has been a main area of my research. And we know very well now that attention is one of those abilities that decline as we get older. And we had many papers from my laboratory showing that our susceptibility to distraction, our inability to multitask, speed of processing, and different aspects of rapid perceptual decision-making decline as we get older. And so in thinking about how we might improve that ability, as a neurologist, the first thing that we tend to think about is, can we give a drug for that? Because it's what we have grown up thinking about as medicine, that you just pop a pill, there's no work to be done, you just do it once a day, and your attention is better. And we did some work with some of the medications that are used to treat Alzheimer's disease with aging to see if they might have an effect, and it was really very subtle, if anything at all. And so I started thinking about how we might use experience as medicine based upon what we've already discussed, that experience-dependent plasticity exists in older adults. There just hasn't been a lot of work on harnessing that in a really targeted manner to lead to these positive outcomes. And so when I was thinking about delivering an experience to older adults to strengthen attention networks, you know, I was attracted to the idea of using a digital interface to do that. And there's lots of reasons for that, but many of them really were of a practical nature. I've become very interested in scale and, you know, wrapping my head around the large burden of problems that we face with our mind and how global it is. Attention is one of them, but also depression and anxiety, issues with memory. With so many people suffering, we need a solution that can be scaled in a global, massive way. And digital technologies have that opportunity, right? They can be pushed to someone's home with a software download. They can be done quite affordably. They can also be really tested in a very rigorous manner through randomized controlled trials, because you could push out different versions that just differ by one ingredient. So this is something that's very difficult to do with medication. And it's also actually difficult to do with human-based experience. Now, I know there's a lot of therapists listening to this, and this is in no way meant to say that humans can't be part of this system. But I was curious over a decade ago on how effectively we could deliver a personalized adaptive experience through a digital technology. And when thinking about that and how to deliver it in a way that someone would engage with deeply and sustainably over time, I arrived at the idea that it should be a video game. And that's what, you know, that's the asset of video games. They're interactive, but they also have lots of reward mechanisms and art and music and story, and they enthrall you and you want to come back to them. And that's what I was looking for in this type of treatment. And so the idea was, can we build a video game that delivers a challenge and system of rewards to older adults in such a way that if they engage with it over the course of a month, we'll show in a randomized trial that we can improve their cognitive abilities. And so NeuroRacer was the game that we created. I had the original design and then developed it with friends of mine in the video game industry. And we went ahead and did multiple years of testing with people of all ages, especially with a focus on healthy older adults over 60 years old. And we wound up publishing that in Nature, which is, you know, as good as it gets for us as scientists. And it was the cover of the journal in September of 2013. And what we showed there was that older adults got better at playing the game. But against two different control groups, we also improved their ability to pay attention on a really boring task, very different than gameplay, and their ability to hold faces in mind for short periods of time, something we call working memory. And one other additional piece to this, that we recorded neural activity during gameplay and showed the neural mechanisms of what the plasticity response was in their brain that led to these improvements and even led to some durability of effect 6 months later. And so that was the biggest moment in certainly in my scientific career and the many people involved in that study, because it took what was sitting sort of in the realm of entertainment, maybe not some way dissimilar to where psychedelics have sat, and brought it into the forefront of thinking about it in a very careful way as a precisely delivered targeted treatment. But it was just the beginning. I mean, this was a small study. It was what I say, a study looking for a signal. And after that, and this is a long story because it's a whole decade and I'm not going to tell the whole thing, but you know, that led to the company formation, patent formation, things that I knew nothing about, multiple clinical trials, and eventually to a large scale trial showing that this same treatment delivered in a much, much better video game, but with the same underlying active ingredients that was in NeuroRacer, can improve attention abilities in children with ADHD. And that's what led to the recent, last year, 2020, the recent approval of this game by the FDA as a class 2 medical device. So it's the first non-drug digital treatment for children with inattention suffering ADHD, and making it the first FDA approved video game, which is very exciting. Long journey to get there, but to us, it's just the beginning of what we hope is this new field of experiential medicine.
It was a long journey, and it's brought you to the precipice of an entirely new long journey, it seems, and that's the NeuroScape Psychedelic Research Division. You've brought over Robin Carhart-Harris to lead that division, and couldn't have chosen a better researcher in the estimation of many psychonauts. So it's wonderful that Robin's there. And Robin's done a lot of work in terms of looking at the context of psychedelic experiences. And when you're designing video games, a lot of what you're designing there is kind of the context of the experience. So if it was just simply the reward of like press a button and you get like a pleasing sound or something like that, that doesn't quite give you the same experience as an entire storyline, as something to strive and achieve. So in the video game component, you really need an entire context to support
that reward system to support that kind of learning. In the psychedelic world, we call this set and setting. The molecule affects the brain in many ways, which we can talk about in neuroplasticity itself. But so much about the psychedelic experience is about the set and setting, whether that's an ayahuasca ceremony with the incense and the Icaros and the sort of shamanic energy of the room, the cohort that you're with, or if you're doing ketamine-infused therapy, you have an eye mask on. There's specific ways that this is all done. And my understanding is that this context of psychedelic therapy is the thing that you're most interested in studying. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, you said it perfectly. And that was really the connection that Robin and I had when we met. I flew out to UK and gave talks at Oxford and Imperial at Robin's invitation to really tell them the story that what we've been working on at Neuroscape is part of the psychedelic treatment story, even though we've never did any research with psychedelics. And that's because we essentially study set and setting, minus the psychedelics. That's what we do. We create an environment for a participant, study the elements that they enter that with that maximize enduring positive change. That is the very hallmark of what set and setting is and what contextual elements of an experience that lead to positive outcomes is all about. So it was really reading Michael's book that made me realize that although psychedelics are molecularly initiated, they're also an experiential medicine. And once I put that together, I realized that we have so much to offer at Neuroscape to this field, because from everything we do, from how do we build reward mechanisms and set up environments to lead to neuroplasticity, but also all the recording of physiology during the plasticity-inducing event so that we can optimize it through closed loop. All of this seemed to me to be incredibly applicable to this aspect of psychedelic research. And that's what I presented to Robin and his group in the UK. And we were pretty much bonded after that, because it's also the foundation of a lot of his research and interests, both his empirical work as well as the theoretical papers that he's written on mechanism are really about the same thing that attracted me to psychedelic research more recently. And so it was a very natural coming together. It wasn't a long, complicated recruitment. We just realized that it made sense for us to work together. And not just me, but we have a whole team of scientists and programmers and technologists and signal processing engineers at Neuroscape that haven't done any psychedelic research, but are really intrigued by it and have a lot of unique talents and assets to bring into the field. So it's not the only thing that we'll work on, but as Robin now flies out to San Francisco very soon, next week, I think it's next week, and joins us, and he's already on faculty since July 1st, what the division will focus on, one of the things I think that are most unique for our contribution into this field, is really understanding in a fine-grained way what are the elements of context, and not just the context during, but set and setting being the elements that happen before that set you up, how you incorporate these elements of the peak experience during the event into your life afterwards, and then how can we optimize that to deliver better treatments. There's just so much to do. It's really humbling to look at the number of research studies that we could come up with in just an hour and say, okay, how do we prioritize and move through this methodically? Because there's a lot of work to do. But that is the main focus of what we're interested in.
Yeah, there is a staggering amount of work and research that can be done. And I see this collection of all these specialists, all these different scientists that are working at Neuroscape, and just the amount of resources that will be available for someone like Robin and yourself and other people who want to propose some research studies there. One of the ways that you're going to be conducting the research is something called multimodal biosensing. And so I'd love it if you could talk a little bit about how are you actually going to be reading someone's psychedelic experience? What are the tools that are going to allow you to get a sense of this person is in a stressful situation and now they're not, there's some healing that is happening. What are the tools to sense that?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest technical and neuroscientific challenges and engineering challenges that we face right now, is to be able to record in real time the state of an individual in the moment And we're actually doing work on that at Neuroscape already, looking at how to record that during meditation and music experiences, minus the psychedelic. So again, we were already doing the psychedelic research work because it's still important to be able to stay in any state, and we still have very little capacity to do so. So I just want to be clear, we're not necessarily going to be able to map out the detailed content of someone's thoughts, exactly who they're thinking about or a time period. But if we can get a reflection of their level of arousal, the valence, whether it's positive or negative, whether their attention is internal or external and sustained or fragmented, and even a reflection of their awareness. Now, capturing that is going to be challenging, but that is one of our main missions right now, is to be able to do that. And in order to do it, the reason why we call it multimodal biosensing is that we are all absolutely convinced that there's no single tool that will allow us to do that. The brain is too complicated, and we don't have a lens that we could focus with the precision to be able to determine all of that, certainly not in real time in a human brain. And so the hypothesis that we have is that by capturing data across multiple different channels, both brain-based as well as in the body, physiological measures like heart rate and heart rate variability, galvanic skin response, as well as measures of heart contractility that are very new that we're working with. There's approaches using facial expression, body movements, pupillometry, eye movements, and as well as some sophisticated ways of experience sampling, having an individual as best as they're capable of expressing what's going on with them. And that could be as simple as a squeeze ball or a joystick. Putting all of these together is the challenge, right? That they're all telling us a little piece of the story of what's happening in someone's mind. And this is where the signal processing and machine learning aspects of this come in. Once you record all this data, how do you integrate it together and give a composite measure of where someone is in the moment? So that's the approach that we're going about. Some of this takes place inside an MRI scanner. Other aspects don't. And there's a lot of work to be done. But peering inside the black box while someone goes through a psychedelic treatment to us is critical to be able to optimally guide them to a good place. And so that's what we hope to contribute over the next decade, is more granularity in picking up really sensitive and reliable measures of someone's state in the moment.
Wow. Yeah, peering into that black box. There are these traditions, longstanding traditions, particularly indigenous shamanism, that purport to maybe not peer into the black box, but have kind of a sense of what that black box most needs. Whether that's a kind of incense, whether that's the addition of another compound like rape or hape in an ayahuasca ceremony. There are things that shamans seem to intuitively know. You were on Tim Ferriss's podcast recently, and one of the things that I enjoyed most in listening to you speak to Tim was your conversation about your personal exploration of the therapeutic journey by having conversations with therapists and indigenous elders over time. And so as you're talking about peering into this black box, I'm so encouraged, and I'm sure all our listeners are encouraged, that your starting point to peer into the black box was not, let's get that box open as quick as possible, but rather, let's have conversations with these therapists, with these shamans, with these individuals who have, at the very least, an intuitive understanding. And also, in many cases, an indigenous lineage, a time-honored collection of traditions. So I'm curious, what are some of the things that you learned over the course of those conversations that are informing the research that you're about to undertake now?
Yeah, it's a favorite conversation of mine. I think it's a really, at least from my, I could tell, a unique approach to scientific research, is not just basing it on your own intuition or knowledge of the scientific literature, or even knowledge of the specific field like neuroscience, but going out into the field and talking to people that have vast amounts of wisdom and experience, and sometimes experience across multiple generations, as you described, not even their own personal experience, and try to glean as much value from those conversations as possible so that we can guide our research based upon that. And it's really been a lot of fun and very eye-opening to do so. So, for example, I have a whole list of questions that I've used just so I could sort of make it systematic when I talk to someone. And I plan on doing this for as long as I can, as long as I'm engaged in this field, because it's, I just find it so interesting. But I would say when you have someone with you that you're a guide for and they're in a psychedelic state, what are the signs that you use to know that someone is suffering? Now, some people that I talk to might be not very good at communicating that. They just say maybe more of a feeling, but that's not the most common thing that I hear. Usually, once it starts flowing, a long list of things that they'll use. And so they'll say, for example, vocalizations. So someone might vocalize in some way. And then I'm like, oh, okay, well, we could record voice pretty easily and timestamp any vocalization to any other event. So taking notes on that, body posture, right? So there might be a clenching of the body, a certain type of movement of going into a fetal position. Okay, well, we could use both cameras and EMG to record even subtle body movements, like the type of clenching that someone might not even see or be able to notice. We would be able to record. Also related to body movements, facial movements, grimacing, and other signs. And this is, you know, what they're looking for. And it's, I would say it's not only intuition. It maybe seems like intuition, but, you know, many of these individuals have been doing it for 30 years. So it turns into intuition, but it starts as just a slow progress of accrual of information from careful observation. And it's amazing. And these people are the best in the world at delivering this care. But is it reproducible? Sure, but reproducible at scale? Challenging. And so what I'm looking for are ways of capturing what they have learned through their vast amount of experience and then making it more accessible to people that might be newer as therapists to be able to now get the signals that are too subtle for them, that they just don't have the experience to pick up on. So those are those are some examples of what I would hear when talking to someone, and they go on through the full list of ways that they may notice that someone is suffering or someone is thriving. And then from there, after going through all the signals they get, maybe ask, well, how long do you keep them in that state? Do you never intervene? Do you intervene? What is the trigger for you upon which you make a decision to engage in some way? And that varies, again, immensely, and something that we're very interested in. And then how do you intervene? What do you do? And again, tons of variability, maybe softly laying hands on shoulders to give a sense that they're here and supported. Giving assent is fairly common in the field, but almost unheard of in a scientific research study of psychedelics. So again, that's another area of disconnect that we want to fill in. Asking, sometimes having people sit up, open their eyes. So there's all sorts of different ways that the environment can be changed to help support someone as they go through a treatment, whether it's a negative or a positive experience that's occurring. So that's just a little bit of how my process of going about educating myself and bringing those lessons into our experimental design process. Now, some things may be inaccessible to us in a research laboratory. They're just more suitable for things in the real world, like dance is challenging, and others, and large interpersonal connectivity, experiments in nature itself, challenging. But other things are not that challenging. Like I said, recording vocalizations and body movements, changing scent can be delivered digitally. Of course, music and other forms of basic movement are all accessible to us. So that's the process. It's one of education and then translation to our domain of empirical research to come up with appropriate experimental designs that allow us to say, how reproducible are these metrics that a therapist may be using in the field to record experience, and how can we make them accessible to more people?
Yeah, you were talking about how scents are often used in the field, but not in a scientific laboratory. There's so many things like that. The scientific laboratory approach is like the eye mask, the music, and then the healing of psychedelics takes place in so many different landscapes, one of which is in community. And I believe there was research recently that came out around community healing for psychedelics. Something came on my radar that I just want to share with you. A fellow named Aaron Orsini wrote a book called Autism on Acid. And he was actually using LSD personally in his life, and he's been out about this, at very small doses as an autistic person in social environments. Now, he goes to great lengths to say, don't do this. You know, you need a support system. If you are autistic, please don't just take a bunch of acid and go out in the world. But the idea of using that molecule, LSD, in the context of a social environment, using it as, he says, a neurological contact lens, is an entirely different application in terms of psychedelic medicine. Now, how on earth do we study that? And at what point do we study that? But in the case of Aaron, he was able to experience what it meant to socialize in a completely different way. And then he could remove that molecule and still be able to access some of that. So it really did transform his life in that way. And so there's just so many ways to look at this kind of healing. And I love the indigenous traditions, the ceremonial medicines. I'm curious, are there any sort of, you were talking about how like it's difficult to do this kind of research in nature. I'm sure it's difficult in a cohort setting. Have you had your eye on a cohort setting at all, or on some of these indigenous medicines like an ayahuasca or San Pedro or similar? Has that been on your radar, or at the moment, is it more looking at what's most replicable in a lab, perhaps psilocybin with its 5-hour duration, or maybe ketamine?
Well, you know, we're laboratory-based scientists. That's our bread and butter. We want to double down on what our skill set is and really see how many things that have not been researched in the lab but are very common in the field, like the role of scent, even visual presentation, movement, and other aspects during treatment might be empirically accessible. So studyable in a way that gives us the data that allows us to move these treatments into clinical practice. So that's where we are excited to begin. And psilocybin is really accessible for that. That's really our starting point. We are also interested in MDMA work, and maybe even the combination somewhat of MDMA and psilocybin in different ways. Jenny Mitchell, who's also faculty now at Neuroscape, was the lead on the recent paper in Nature Medicine on the MAPS trial of MDMA for PTSD treatment, which is also going on at Neuroscape. And so she's another brilliant researcher and a person that we're really excited to be working with. So those two compounds are really interesting to us. I'm personally very interested in LSD as well. I think that it could have a very powerful effect here, but its duration of action is challenging for us. We do have another researcher that will be joining us that has done work with ayahuasca in more natural settings. So that is another skill set that we're bringing on board. I wouldn't say that anything's off the table, including DMT. It's all interesting. We just have to think about the way that we can use the methodology that we have to contribute something valuable. In terms of nature, I just want to pause on that because we brought it up a couple of times. I'm a massive nature fan, as you could see. This is a photo I shot in the Grand Canyon last year. I'm a nature photographer, and I've had some of my most profound transformative experiences, not necessarily with psychedelics, but in nature. And there is an incredibly interesting but still young literature showing that nature has a lot of similar effects, or can have similar effects, to psychedelic treatments, even minus the psychedelics. And bringing the two together is really interesting to all of us on our team at Neuroscape. And how we do that is challenging. One way that we're interested in pursuing that is through creating immersive sensory experiences using the latest and even the future visions of what virtual reality could be, to build nature experiences that can be done indoors, in places where people, you know, might not have access to real world nature in urban environments. And, you know, it's not the same. I'm not going to say it's the same, but we think that there's a lot that can be done with digital presentation through high resolution visual images and smells and sounds of forests, coupled with psychedelics, maybe even a lower dose of psychedelics, given the strong sensory environment that we're creating, that can bring out a lot of the value that nature has on the mind, on stress and mood and anxiety and sleep. Then there's also the role of nature before in the prep phase that can be done more easily than the treatment itself, as well as the integration and processing stage after a treatment can also be done in nature, real nature. So those are some areas that we're also very fascinated by and have been incredibly under-researched.
As you mentioned the role of nature before and after a psychedelic experience, it reminds me of the enormous role of not simply preparation and integration, but an ongoing journey of healing. And I'm curious, with this new research division, as you're conceptualizing research, what do you think about the ongoing journey of psychedelic healing? Whether that be the specifics of a single experience that has a long integration component to it, or multiple experiences with a single molecule, say a series of 5 ketamine treatments, or even further, using a number of different molecules over time to grow out of challenging mindset, bad habits, some trauma, some ill health, and actually going through a journey of healing that involves much more than simply these experiences alone. Is that, I mean, I know we're probably way ahead of ourselves here, but
no, it's great.
Thinking about that and how so?
Yeah, we're thinking about that a ton because despite the fact that some people have this transformative, mystical experience that leads to long-lasting benefits, that's not true of everyone. Not everyone benefits right away, and some people benefit, and then the benefits dissipate over time, and they relapse. Maybe it's an addiction study, and there's a period where they're back to whatever brought them to the treatment in the first place, a relapse of depression. And so we're really focused on the long-term approach to leading to a lifetime of positive benefit. And that may involve multiple psychedelic treatments, but I think the dream is that we would be able to limit the sort of really powerful psychedelic treatments to more limited amounts and to use other approaches, other experiential approaches that may be more sustainable over time to help these effects endure. And so for example, how we might be able to have several treatments with a psychedelic that then is followed by a period of meditation, mindfulness, nature-based practices that allow those immediate benefits to last longer. I mean, that's an incredibly interesting area for us. You know, the role of experience and plasticity, what we talked about going back to the beginning of this conversation, there is, you know, two big fields here. There is this practice-based repetitive experience like meditation and mindfulness, where it's a 20-year journey to reach these levels that you're attaining or more. And then there is what we're talking about now, where there may be a single peak experience that occurs in a moment that leads to enduring change. And I'm interested, you know, I'm always trying to break down silos, and that's sort of my hobby, the thing I enjoy the most, and trying to think about how we can integrate really powerful, life-changing moment experiences with more long-term practice-based repetitive experiences is a very exciting area of research that I think is going to be critical to have these compounds yield the maximal benefit.
I so agree with you. And I think that what we're looking at here is also a cultural shift in medicine and healing, rather than the kind of like prescription procedure approach, let's do it as quickly as possible and get you back to life and get you back to normal. Well, when we're talking about experiential medicine of this caliber, we're not trying to get back to normal. We're actually trying to step into a fuller blossoming of ourselves. And what I've found in my own journey with this kind of healing and with the people that I know in my life is that these different tools and habits come along for the ride. You have that eye-opening experience, we are all one, whatever metaphysical aha. And then suddenly it makes a little more sense to do yoga. Not sure why, but, you know, not sure why yoga, not sure why meditation, but it's, you know, what we eat and how we live. And I personally feel that the psychedelic renaissance, and indeed what can be a cultural revolution with the galvanizing force of psychedelics, can be around the way we actually live, to the point that we're not needing the molecules themselves to get there. We can go to nature, we can go to meditation. And so I think that the perspective that you have is so important for someone who's doing the kind of research you're doing, because you so clearly are not coming from that more limited philosophical perspective of let's treat sickness as quickly as possible. Rather, let's cultivate wellness in communities broadly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is why I sort of got into this field, my version of the field, using the digital technologies like video games, even before psychedelics, why I got into it in the first place, is that we've been in this paradigm, and I think paradigm, it's an overused term, but it's appropriate here, but a paradigm that somewhere out there is a magic brain pill, and it's going to fix everything, and we are searching for it, but we haven't found it, but we're going to find it. And once we do, it's all better. Depression, autism, post-traumatic stress disorder, dementia, Alzheimer's is gone. And we have not, we've been looking for that magic brain pill for 70 years now. And I don't think we're going to find it. I don't actually think that there is going to be just a fix for all these conditions of the mind that we struggle with. They are going to be new ways of engaging with ourselves and our environment that make us healthier and can be sustained. And I don't view psychedelics as a magic brain pill at all. That's why I put it in a different category. It is an adjustment, a shuffling of the deck, so to speak, that allows you to sort of step out of some grooves in the road that you've been stuck in and also increase your plasticity. But there's a lot more around it that needs to be added to the recipe to give the type of benefits that we are looking for. And that's what really gets me excited about this. Not that we've just fixed everything by that simple pill fix. That's not really what this is going to be in my mind.
Okay, so in your ideal view, what would the experience of a psychedelic therapist be like once we're using these multimodal biosensing tools, so we're getting real-time information about the patient's experience? Can you describe to me what it would be like in this kind of distant view? You're a psychedelic therapist. You have these tools at your disposal. You're working with someone. What's that experience like?
All right. Well, I'll give a futuristic view, an example from the future that may or may not appeal to people. And this is not the way it has to be, but it's a vision that I have that has guided a lot of our work. And it can be done in lots of different ways. But here's one. So again, this is an approach that's based on data, lots of data. So it's something that can't happen tomorrow. But if you imagine us 10 years in the future, and imagine you're a therapist, a psychedelic therapist, and helping someone with, let's say, post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's their first visit, this patient or research participant, depending on where we're at, has already had a deep biometric evaluation that's taken multiple days so that we can understand them, their physiology, their neural network composition, their genetics, aspects of their lives, their intentions in a very deep way. So that from the moment we begin this personalization, right? What are the compounds we want to use? What are the doses? And how do we want to set up the opening context of their first experience, the first of many different types of experiences that'll take them to a healthier state? So that's a good starting realm, because the treatment doesn't begin with the first therapeutic administration, right? There is a great deal of learning that I believe needs to happen to create a personalized therapy. Then during the treatment itself, I picture being able to apply these sensors in the future. We could do it in a way that's very non-invasive, non-threatening to the patient. And the therapist could, you know, administer the compound. Let's say it's psilocybin, for lack of a better one right now in this discussion. And the therapist would then have access to an entire, let's say, a visualization to make it accessible, maybe putting on even a virtual reality headset and being able to see what I think of as an experience landscape. So picture a mountain range where all these different aspects, these peaks and valleys, are reflecting different aspects of stress and arousal and attention and awareness, and you're watching it change over time. So you're not quite in their brain, but getting a visualization of their mind as they go through this journey. So again, peering inside the black box is now possible. And the therapist has all of this data that they're receiving that allows them to understand where the person is in that moment. Now, trying to guide an experience with this much data could be overwhelming because you don't necessarily have access to all the data about what these things mean or where it's good for someone to be. So I see this as like an AI companion that a therapist would have that's helping give suggestions about what they're seeing and what it means based upon a decade of data and the deep understanding of this individual. So you can imagine that 2 hours in, the person is in a place of high stress, so great arousal, negative valence, internal attention, and maybe even low awareness. So they're struggling. Let's say this is the signature of struggle. And the AI companion is suggesting that someone like this person who has not had an experience like this should be in this struggle, but for 15 minutes. After that, data would suggest that the outcome might actually be more negative than positive. And so after the 15 minutes, the suggestion is that these are some of the sensory levers that you can push and pull to move this person from this state to a sort of cool down state, right? So maybe it's the sound of a waterfall and a low frequency vibration and a smell of pine trees, or maybe a visualization asking them to open their eyes and see a sky of clouds above them. And, you know, the data would suggest that 98% of people move to a cooler state, one of external attention, one of lower levels of stress, more positive valence, and that this would be a good time to start going on the off-ramp, and we could revisit it another time. So that's an example that I always see in my mind of how a therapist would be there to help with the human connection and the guidance, but now have this rich data set of what is going on with the individual in the moment, as well as all these tools that they can use to help guide them in the most effective way through this experience.
So I think that for some of our listeners, that seems like an extraordinary tool. An AI associate would be an extraordinary tool that would help advance their practice. However, for some listening, they might be a little suspicious, a little worried. Well, what's the point of the therapist? Maybe this AI companion is going to displace the therapist entirely. And when a lot of these wounds are actually coming from a disconnection to begin with, whether it's complex PTSD as a child or depression or autism, there's a disconnection there. I can imagine that there's a fear on some listeners that this AI associate might overtake the need for a therapist altogether. And with scalability being what it is, and with for-profit companies being what they are, that there would be an incentive to try to displace the therapist. I'm curious if that's been brought up to you as a concern, and how you feel about that concern.
Yeah, it has been raised, and I think about it myself, and I'm a physician myself. Like I see great value to the role of the human in this system, and my vision is certainly not one of replacement, but as everything, you know, that we do with technology, it should be to serve humans and to give humans a better set of tools to accomplish their goals. And in this place, their goal is to help someone else. I don't think that this would work as effectively without a human in the loop, so to speak. I think that the value of AI here is to be able to do computations and make connections that a human may struggle to do, but to offer that as information for someone to then, a person, to make a decision about what should be applied right now, right or wrong. But it's complex, and I could see the threat and the fear. You know, and every field of medicine is going through this right now. Like radiologists afraid that some AI X-ray film reader is just going to replace them from a job. And yet that has not happened. And you still see the need across all of medicine to have human beings involved in every aspect of healthcare. I think that it will be clear over time that having a human connection from many perspectives, not the least of which is the patient, knowing that there is a person there with them that cares about them, that is looking out for them. And despite the fact that we're in the future and there's lots of data and tools and analytics, there's another person there that is guiding them and protecting them and helping the best way they could, is going to be critical for the clinical outcome. So, you know, I think that we just have to stay grounded in the fact of what technology is for. And it's really to enhance us as humans. This is like the whole discussion of AI in the first place. You know, how do you avoid the Terminator future? Is that, well, AI should always be in the service of making humans better at who we are, not in replacing us. And I feel pretty strongly about that. But it's very important to have these discussions, to approach it, you know, with honesty and transparency, that these are our concerns, as scale is important. And we already talked about, I think it's really important to return to what our core values are and make sure that we're respecting them at every stage of this.
Yeah. And on the side of the danger of an AI replacement, there's the alternative to that is no technological support at all. And these medicines absolutely must be scaled because we are in a ballooning mental health crisis. I mean, we were in a mental health crisis before COVID. Things are just getting harder for people. And while there are therapists and shamans who've been working for 30 years, and they may well have the intuition, the skill set, and the experience that they know how to navigate these spaces just marvelously. And I've met people who do. But we need so many more practitioners, and we don't really have the luxury of that kind of apprenticeship with the scale of the people who need the support. So having some kind of hybrid model with really sophisticated training and apprenticeship, stuff like CIIS are doing, or some of the different integration coaching networks, like there's really good training coming in, but then having the technological tools are going to be helpful for safety, which is super important. And then for the issue that, again, you brought this up on Tim Ferriss's podcast, and you used an expression that I want to reference here. If we don't have scalability, we don't have accessibility, and then psychedelics become, as you said, a tool for the elite. Now, this is an issue that's very near and dear to my heart. Psychedelics help us enhance. They help us grow spiritually. They help us be more productive, be more effective. And if it's only accessible to the wealthiest amongst us, then not only do these psychedelics not produce the revolution in healthcare that we want, they actually could be a tool in widening gaps of inequality. So from that perspective, we really must scale, and we need technological tools wisely crafted to do so.
I mean, I could not have said it better. It's what inspires us to do this. It's really to address the massive need that we see globally now for people looking for solutions to improve how their minds work and how they feel and love and think. And remember, we need better approaches. And that's what I wake up every day trying to do. And technology is not, you know, it's, you can't just say it's not a Band-Aid. It's not like another magic brain pill, it just happens to be AI. These are really complex interactive systems that we're trying to create that involve humans and different sensor technologies and different sensory stimulation approaches. And we need to do so thoughtfully, but we really need to move faster. Anyone that deals with clinical populations and sees the need, and as you said, COVID has aggravated a lot of this, especially in children. And children and psychedelics as an area is incredibly complicated. We're not even going to go there right now, but we, you know, whether or not it's through this approach or another, we need to move faster. We have not done service to society with what we've done over the last 70 years, in my opinion. We're at a crisis phase. I wrote this piece a couple of years ago called The Cognition Crisis, where I really tried to break down the fact that we're at a crisis of our minds right now. We're not evolving how we think at the level that the rest of the world is changing. And it just feels so much more, you know, often as a writer, and I've written a book before, that it often feels out of date by the time it's in print. But this is a story that, if anything, just keeps getting more and more relevant. And you see it in subtle ways and in the news and things you read that make you feel a certain way. And you're like, we're just not doing so well. And besides all like the true pathological conditions that need treatments, just in terms of how our minds are functioning and dealing with a complicated world, not the least of which is how we manage long, time-delayed, complex decisions like climate change. Like, just yet another example. We need to elevate the whole human mind up a couple levels if we're going to deal with all of these things.
Oh, I love that. I love that perspective. And I share your passion. I mean, it's an existential risk to upgrade humans' ability to respond to these crises. It's fundamental. And I love that you're at the helm of such a prestigious research division at UCSF looking at this. We're coming to the end of our time today, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to speak directly to the therapists or aspiring therapists that are listening to this program. You've shared a lot today that's been really inspiring, and I can imagine that a lot of folks would be like, I'd like to get involved, I'd like to work with you. So I'll have some time at the very end to share about that. In this moment, what would you most like to say to this rising cohort of healers and caregivers that may someday be using tools that you yourself are working to develop along with Robin and the team there? What would you like to share with those people?
Well, it's a great honor to talk to this group of people. I think they're a critical part of this story. And I spend, as I said, a tremendous amount of time reaching out and talking to therapists at all different stages of their careers to try to understand what motivates them and the tools that they use. So I would say be brave and be fearless. And you're entering a challenging field, one that's going to be full of all sorts of unexpected hurdles. I'm in this field now too, and they're happening to me all the time as well. But this is, I really think, the future of medicine and what we can do to help so many people. So part of what I want to say is just stick with it and be tenacious, because there'll be a lot of things preventing you from accomplishing these goals. But to me, they seem really worthy. And then more specifically to the things I talked about here, you know, you may not be a very technologically savvy person or be even technophobic in some ways, and that's okay. I'm not asking you to just swallow everything I said and take the red pill immediately, but I'm asking you to keep an open mind and realize that there are many sets of tools that may help you do your job better at helping other people, and that's really what we're trying to do. So, you know, this is going to be a slowly evolving story. The things I talked about are not here. The work that we're doing is so fundamental that we're setting up now, so non-futuristic in some ways, because we realize that a lot of that hasn't been done yet, which is amazing. So it's not like you're going to have to, you know, digest and participate in everything I described to you tomorrow. But I think it is nice and important to know that this work is being done, and hopefully it will give you a set of tools that make you more effective.
I love that. I love that. And I love getting the foundation right. And I think it's so interesting, because you're doing this kind of middle piece of the set and setting and the context. And then Dr. Yehuda is doing like so much basic science work. And there's other institutions. And you've got Robin over from Imperial College London. Like, for me as a podcaster who has the privilege of speaking to many of you who are working in these different pockets, it's so marvelous to see it coming together and to see this fundamental research being done and this vision of future research. And so, yeah, I'm thrilled. I'm personally so excited about the work you're doing. I'm so excited you got Robin involved. How can our listeners connect with you, connect with Neuroscape, potentially if you're looking for therapists to talk to or participate in research? I'm sure there are people listening who are like, I would love to help out. How can people support you and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so we have a lot of work cut out for us right now. We're just trying to get this division off the ground during COVID, bringing Robin over internationally. It's slow work, but we're moving, and we are, you know, collecting stories and the names of people who are interested in joining us. And I sort of preface this that we don't have capacity right now for everyone that wants to directly contribute to us. That's just the truth. We're getting our legs under us, so to speak. But we do want to know about you. You can certainly shoot me an email. And I have a big file that I share with Robin and Jenny and our other faculty who are joining us, that as we have capacity to engage with more people, this is where we're going to find a lot of those names. We also have a mailing list on Neuroscape that will keep you up to date on the work that we're doing, both in psychedelics and outside psychedelics. And so there's a lot of things that you may be interested in, and we update that pretty regularly. So I'd say it's fair to reach out and express your interests, your intentions, and also, or to follow along and hear about our research and the opportunities that we'll publish.
I love that. Well, we'll have all of that in the show notes, so you can join that mailing list and stay up to date with Adam and what's happening at Neuroscape. When does Robin gets here next week? Is it just off to the races?
Yep. Next week. We've been working already, just remotely like everyone else. I mean, coming here, he's still working remotely. UCSF is still remote. But it is nice to have him and his family here in the Bay Area. We're very, very excited that he's physically joining us. But we've been working. We're raising money now. We're trying to build a new research facility, 4 new labs and a whole cutting-edge center. We're writing our proposals. What are the first sets of studies that we will do together? And so we have 3 proposals. So we're busy at work prepping for the future. But yes, we'll be physically together next week. So that's great.
Wow, I cannot wait to hear what comes out of those labs. That's so exciting.
Thank you.
Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been really elucidating for me personally, I'm sure for my audience, and just really appreciate your time and all the work that you're doing in this field. So thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.